Welcome to Beyond the Bonnet. I'm Max, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Rory and Daniel today in the studio. And this week, we're covering major political developments in the UK and abroad. From the Green Party's shock win in the Gorton and Denton by-election, and what it could mean for Sir Keir Starmer's leadership. And in our extended international segment, we'll examine escalating tension between the United States, Israel, and Iran, including the reported death of Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah, and what that means for regional stability, oil markets, and Western foreign policy. We'll break down what's happening, why it matters, and what it could mean for voters and global security. So let's get into it. So firstly, we're going to be talking about the Greens' win in Gorton and Denton and what this means for Keir Starmer's leadership. So just to summarise for our listeners who may not have heard about the breaking news, in a surprise by-election result just last week, the Green Party has captured Gorton and Denton, a constituency long considered safely under the control or under the provision of Labour. And this is not just a local upset. This is politically symbolic. So this seat was previously held by Labour with a comfortable margin for a long period of time. And Hannah Spencer, the MP now for Gorton and Denton, her campaign was focused on housing affordability, public transport, climate policy, and opposition to local development plans. And a lot of younger voters and urban people living in urban areas showed significant movement towards the Green Party. So to kick it off, Rory, welcome. Welcome to the show.
That's great to be back.
what do you make of this? What do you think this means?
I think before we kind of go further, I think it's really important to recognise that this is a left-wing seat. In 2019, the Labour MP, as of 2025, before he, or 2026 even,
before he stepped down from health problems,
he won the seat. He won 71% of the vote.
So quite
yes,
a majority.
At the general election, he only won 50% of the vote. So that's down 21%.
So it was almost telegraphed that he was going to lose.
No, that's not the point. The point is it's a very left-wing seat. And the only reason that he went down was because the Greens went up. So I think also...
Why did the Greens go up?
Because Starmer isn't left-wing. Labour is no longer left-wing. And so that's why they've lost his seat, because Labour aren't left-wing. This is a left-wing seat, so they're never going to win it. The Greens are left-wing. Last week, I said that, or our prediction was, that the Greens would win. They've won by a much more comfortable margin than anyone would
have expected. And Labour's been pushed into third place.
I'm not surprised about that. But
me neither, to be honest.
But the point is, it's a left-wing seat. So the Greens were inevitably going to win because they are the left-wing party of Britain nowadays, because Labour, half the time they're trying to be Greens, and the rest of the time they're trying to be Labour.
The left-wing party of the UK.
Yeah, there's obviously left-wing, centre-left, centre-right. Then you've also got your extremes.
Yeah. No,
the left-wing party of the UK right now is the Green Party.
It's the Greens, yeah.
Undeniable. Far left, or why it's called the lunatics, would be people like your party. Greens, some aspects of that may be infringing on that. What do you think there, Daniel?
I think you're right with your party. Like, I think that is quite far left, and yeah, I disagree with most of what they have to say. But I think that, like, for a long time, the Greens have been kind of like being kept in a box, and I think like we should be listening to what they have to say. At the moment, like, it's a clear telltale sign of like probably like the UK being more polarized, or just Labour moving more into.
But do you think that centrist? Like Zach Polanski and it's like his charisma, like connecting with younger people, do you think his charisma is connecting with younger people?
Yeah, of course. I think so. I think that like young people are generally, I think, like either liberal or extremely far right. I think most of the time they're quite liberal, like socialist views.
Yeah. Mm.
So I think I'm not surprised by that, and I think people are drawn towards Philadelphia's charisma.
Yeah,
and
to be honest, I sort of, you've got my view on it as well. Mm. I sort of feel like that credit has to go where it's due. You know, Zach Polanski and Nigel Farage, they're doing a great job of being able to galvanise particularly the young population who maybe weren't as involved in politics as they were in the past.
Yeah.
And now his policies are more focused on helping the younger generation.
It's a much more socialist party.
Yeah, it's a much more socialist party.
It's much more broader, but like, as far as policy is concerned, they're no longer the Green.
Yeah, they're no longer the Greens.
They're no longer the environmental party. They're the ones.
So they're branching out now, aren't they?
Yeah, you've got to get exclusive left wing. They're basically the left wing portion of the Labour Party.
Okay.
The Labour Party's moved now.
Yeah, yeah. And to be honest, I feel like Zach Polanski and Nigel Farage are probably some of the best communicators at getting their message. I don't think that Keir Starmer is a particularly inspiring public speaker, would you guys say?
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd die on that. Yeah, of course,
well,
I agree.
Well, I think there's something to say about the fact that, you know, obviously that they're like not, the Labour aren't as left-wing as they were. And I think there's something to do with the fact, like, so the extreme views from both of those, Zach Polanski and Nigel Farage, that have something to do with inspiring when, like, for, well, it's obvious to say that when people see, like, a great decline in the country that they live in, or they think that there's been a great decline in the country that they live in, then they're going to look to more extreme views. Mm. I think that's obvious to say. So when, like, those parties do have those more extreme views, they find that more inspiring than someone who's trying to be correct all the time.
Because, yeah, like, so clearly
watching
that's
what
not
he
working.
Says.
Yeah, that hasn't worked.
Yeah.
But, like, going back to the by-election itself, rather than the takeaways and the trends, which we'll talk about a bit later.
Yeah.
But I think the Green victory, much larger than we thought. Labour going down to third place, I'm not surprised, actually.
Yeah,
they had a pretty bad candidate, to be honest, as in uncharismatic.
Yeah.
No one really knew who they were. If they had Andy Burnham, it would have been a sweep. I saw one poll where actually his majority or his vote share would have actually increased from the general election, which would have been, like, that would not have been on my 2026 bingo card. But I think Reform... They like all the polls saying they probably get 30%. They went down 20. They went to 29%, which
still
is double.
Not
which
a
is
bad
so
outcome.
So.
Yeah.
But that's double what they got in 2024. But
the
people
progress
saying,
is progress.
People were saying
it
was a toss up between the three, and the Greens completely like thumped both Labour and Reform because Reform weren't even close. They lost. They lost by 4,000 votes.
Well, no, because Keir Starmer did say, I don't know if maybe it was last year. He said the next general election will be decided between Labour and Reform, is
that
what
was,
he said.
That, yes,
and now,
that was
and now,
before the Greens.
Yeah, now he's just
stage.
Now it's just been very clear that they've been pushed
that was before,
into third place.
That was before Labour's polling collapsed. That was before Reform's polling collapse. That's before the Tories had their little surge, which having a mini surge, if I've been looking at the polls, if you guys have been looking at the polls, in the last week. I think, talking about the Tories, I think it's important. Yes, they only won 1.9% of the vote. Yes, they lost that.
Okay, they were never really going to win.
They were never
going
to win.
So.
And I think that's important that they were never going to win because those voters, all the polls are saying, oh, I'd vote 10%. 10% of the voters in Gorton Dentons would vote for the Conservatives. But I think when they got to the ballot box, I think people vote not by party anymore, but by block or ideology. And if they know that the Conservatives aren't going to win, they're going to send their votes to Reform because they know they're the right-wing party or alternative that actually have a shot in that seat.
Yeah, just to add to that also, like, I saw a few interviews on the news and they was just saying, like, one, I'm going to get onto about the big divide there is in that constituency, which I think is, like, noticeable. But also, like, people, like, I heard a few people just say, oh, I'm going to vote for a Green so Reform don't win.
It's tactical voting.
Tactical voting, yeah. And I think that, obviously, Roy, you're going to disagree with me here. But I think I'm quite glad that, like, the Green Party are being considered a bit more and have been thrust sort of into light a bit more. Like, I'm just glad that they've shown it's possible to sort of win by-elections, stuff like that.
Yeah. So no, I think I'm
really
glad
good.
The Greens won, just for the record. Cause it
oh,
puts,
thanks.
You're glad, okay, yeah.
I'm not, no, but no, but because it puts a lot of pressure on Keir Starmer, and I think he is the greater enemy. I don't think Zach Polanski is going to be the Prime Minister.
The next Prime Minister, he won't be.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have said Nigel Farage would have been the next Prime Minister. Now he could be. Now, actually, it seems like he probably won't be. He'll be short of a majority. One poll I saw today put Reform only on 22%, which is the lowest they've been since this time last year.
Yeah.
So Reform are going down.
Why would you say that is? That Reform are just going down in general? Is it just
I think it's Restore Britain.
Rupert Lowe
I think,
is
yeah,
having
because
an impact.
I think Reform have tried to... That's this is a whole other subject, and I'll go into it briefly. But I think Reform has projected itself as the anti-establishment party for a few years now. And now they're taking on Suella Braverman, former Home Secretary. They're taking on Robert Jenrick, former Housing Secretary.
Yes, yeah, Robert
they're
Jenrick.
Bringing on Nadeem Zahawi, who became Chancellor for precisely 2 days before he decided to resign. So well done, Nadeem. Great experience there.
Fair enough.
He's now there, but they absolutely reek of the establishment. I know I spoke about this. I quite like the establishment, but I'm not as sceptical with the establishment as Reform are. But I think... it's showing the hypocrisy of them being anti-establishment, yet bringing on the Tories. Now they're the Tories 2.0, even though they've got And they're minuscule compared to them.
And we spoke about this last week.
And we spoke about how I thought this is Tory 0.5 or even less. So that's why I think Reform slightly underperformed in not just this seat, but they're underperforming in the polls as well. They underperformed in Caerphilly. They underperformed in the Hamilton by-election in Holyrood last year. And actually, even in Runcorn and Helsby, they slightly underperformed. Yes, they won the seat by 6 votes, but they are projected to win the seat by a little bit more. So I think there's a lot more criticism, not just on the actual policy of Reform, but actually the electoral success of Reform. And I think the people who, or the anti-establishment voters who would have been Reform's core base, they've gone to Restore Britain. And Restore Britain, even though they're kind of doing some pacts or deals, or they're ideologically similar to Advance UK, who did stand a candidate in Nick Buckley.
Who runs Advance UK?
Nick Buckley.
Okay.
He's the candidate, but the actual person, Ben Habib, who was a former
leader. We've spoken about Ben Habib, yeah.
The former deputy leader of Reform UK. Daniel, Ben Habib is far right. Advance UK is far right. They got the endorsement of Tommy Robinson, so they are the
they
far
are the
right.
Far right, yeah. Yeah,
we had a bit of a argument anything.
Off the mic.
We had a passionate debate. What was I going to say?
Ben Habib and
Robinson. Those voters did not turn out to vote for Reform. I'm not saying that if they went out, it would have been crucial to Reform actually winning, but they underperformed slightly, probably due to that. But going on to some other wider things, I think it's really important to Lib Dems as well. Actually, the Tories weren't the only.
The Lib Dems underperforming currently. They've had a bit of a
I don't think
off,
it's more national.
They?
I think, like the Tories, it's a bit more local what went not wrong, so but not, why they didn't win.
The Lib Dems aren't likely to win that. Weren't likely to win.
Yeah,
that
so they
seat
suffered
either.
From tactical voting as well. What's his name? Vince Cable, former leader, said that they should tactically vote for Labour. So.
I
don't know
how
many did that.
Get in, yeah.
A lot probably didn't because Labour significantly underperformed. So the Lib Dems got even less than the Conservatives. They only won 500 votes. They also lost their deposit, so I don't know why no one's talking about that. But I think the key story after the Green victory is Labour's collapse. And I think they had, from the beginning, a really, not a really bad candidate, but they could have had a really good candidate and they decided not to do that.
And
that rests entirely on
Keir Starmer. Candidate.
Yeah, that rests entirely on Keir Starmer.
Well, it's entirely on Keir Starmer blocking off that relationship with Andy Burnham, isn't it?
Well, he got disapproved by the NEC, which Keir Starmer runs, the National Executive Committee, which is basically the main governing executive
body of the Labour Party.
So there's
no way Andy Burnham would run
Party.
Then if Keir Starmer was just going to shut him out.
Well, the NEC's got 10 members, one of which is the Prime Minister, one of which is the Chair, who is Siobhana Mahmood, who decided to abstain from the vote, which is quite crucial because maybe she's not basically going out there defending or denying Andy Burnham. So maybe that's something to do with the leadership challenge or some sort of... But I'm not going to speculate.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is, the NEC is filled to the brim with Starmer loyalists, other than Lucy Powell, who was the only NEC member to vote for Burnham's application to be approved.
And she's the deputy leader.
She's the deputy leader. Yeah. And she's kind of Burnham's sort of representative, or at least his faction in Parliament. So, obviously, Keir Starmer definitely had a lot of influence on whether he got accepted, his nomination got accepted or not. So, I think responsibility for this loss, obviously, falls on Keir Starmer, not just the fact that he appointed a bad candidate, but also his actual policy agenda, his ideological agenda, has completely alienated the left-wing. Well, I mean, let's think about it. Social issues, he's completely got rid of any left-wing base he had, because they've all now gone to the Greens, some maybe to your party if they followed Zara Sultana, God forbid. And also, they're seeing that the people, or the centrists who really want a better economy, let down by Rachel Reeves, so they're going to Reform, they're going to the Conservatives.
And the Lib Dems. Lib Dems, yeah.
Yeah, as well. There's a lot of things moving around, but I think Labour's just getting crushed, not by the left on social issues, but by everyone else on economic issues. Even the Greens are winning on some economic issues with their wealth taxes.
Well, Labour are right at the middle, right in... Well, let's not... Okay, obviously,
it's a two-front war for
obviously Labour on the left, but I want to imagine it like the Greens are on the left, Reform are on the right, and just pretend that Labour's in the middle but getting squeezed, if you know what I mean.
Yes,
squeezed for votes.
Totally, 100%.
Like, obviously, this is like troubled times for Keir Starmer? Where does he go from this? Because I feel like there's a bit of complacency going into this election. They've held the seat for a really long time. Maybe that's the reason why they didn't put forward such a great candidate. And also, to go out after the election, along with reform, and say that families were going into the ballot boxes together and voting with each other.
Yeah.
It's a bit petty, really, to be honest. I mean, you have to accept the defeat, don't you think,
Daniel?
Yeah,
I think also he said in an interview with the BBC, he said governments that are in office don't always, most likely not to win by-elections.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that's supposed to mean. I don't know if it's
There's a lot of anti-incumbency,
true.
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But definitely. I think it's completely naive and, quite frankly, stupid to just deny the fact that the reason that you lost this by-election terribly, you lost half of your votes in a seat that you won astronomically at the last general election. You cannot say that was because, oh, well, anti-incumbency. That's not anti-incumbency. That is absolute failure on a load of fronts, on the economy, on a lot of things are coming out of my head right now. Economy, social issues, foreign policy with Trump. A lot of Lib Dems, they've positioned themselves as the sole anti-Trump party. Greens are trying to emulate that as well. But Labour are now like they're completely playing with Trump. They're controlling them, so that's the reason they've lost.
And I sort of feel like Keir Starmer's not really, as Kevin Badenoch mentioned multiple times, pretty much in every PM keys, he's not the one really running the party, is he?
Well, he's weak.
He's getting controlled pretty much by his cabinet.
He's weak.
And backbench. No, because I agree with you. He's quite weak-minded, to be honest. But
quite. He's very weak.
And obviously, with the spring statement approaching, it's obviously going to be quite important for Rich Reeves and Keir Starmer to lay out the framework and try and get the country back on side, don't you think, Daniel? Maybe? Trying to show, obviously, with the unrest, especially after the last budget and all these different claims about changing interest on university student loans, because obviously there's a large amount of unemployment, especially for graduates leaving the university. I think Keir Starmer really needs to show a bit of backbone here, really, and really
needs to show a vision.
Yeah, well, he obviously needs to show vision as well, but really trust. There's no point in him making U-turns because it just shows that he's even weaker. Okay, so he has to go full in with whatever he's doing. He has to show that he's fully committed, because if he's not, then people who are voting for him aren't going to see that he's not a real leader.
Well, he's not really leading anything, is he?
What do you mean? Go on.
Well, I don't know what, like, if you asked me what's Keir Starmer's main policy agenda. He wants growth without delivering growth. He wants lower migration without actually lowering migration. He wants to...
Okay, well, Shabana Mahmood, obviously, did you see the
Yeah, I know
changes.
She's doing immigration reform, but let's talk about what he's achieved as of yet, not what he's going to achieve in 2 months. He hasn't achieved anything. He's saying that he's bringing migration down. That's net migration, but that's not because you're actually reducing migration. That's because you're increasing emigration of people leaving the country because they think that you're leading it in such a terrible direction.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, yeah.
So I don't think he can claim that's a win. Going back to your student loans, I don't think student loans have made a huge difference in this by-election particularly.
No. This is a completely different thing.
Oh, okay.
I'm not talking about this is not links nothing to the by-election. This is talking about... Because obviously... Kevin Badenoch's called this to change in the spring statement.
Yes,
that's what I mean by he needs to show what his vision is for the future.
Yes, I agree. Yes, I agree. I think Daniel was going to mention it a few minutes ago, but just before we wrap up on all this Gorton Denton stuff, I think it's important to note about the actual demographics of Gorton and Denton. Yeah. So, Daniel, if you want to talk about that.
So, like, there was a big divide in some more interviews with the people of Gorton and Denton, and there's a clear divide Is it Denton, the right-hand side of the...
Denton...
It's like east side of the constituency.
Gorton is the... Actually, I'm not sure. Anyways, one side's on the east, I think.
So there was sort of a clear, very, very clear divide in Gorton and Denton, with Denton sort of high votes for reform, whilst the Denton very much showing... Gorton very much showing... support for the Greens. And it's like, I saw a few interviews of people from Denton saying, like, if you had hypothetically, like, cut the constituency in half, you'd definitely have two separate leaders. So, that's definitely important to note, sort of like the clear divide in the constituency.
Which also important to that, yeah, but also it's not just they've got different politics. There's a lot much larger Muslim population in Gorton
than
Asia, there is
yeah,
in Denton.
Yeah.
And they're far more likely to vote for the Greens because they're much more stronger on their stance with Gaza, which is resonating a lot with Muslim voters.
Yes.
Did a lot in the 2024 Asia. Election. I think it's also really important to note that there are about double the amount of residents inside Gorton than there are Denton. So it was an uphill battle demographically for reform. And their only route to get to power was a split of the left wing. They want to say the Muslim vote in Gorton.
And then they'd win.
And so they would cut through the middle because they'd have enough votes otherwise in Denton to have... Well, in the first boss post system, they would have the most votes out of all the parties, even though they only went like 28% of the vote, which is what happened.
Yes. And I just want to, just to wrap up this segment, if we're just going to talk about summarise the key leadership questions from this. So Keir Starmer has, he's prioritised moderation and fiscal discipline. Can we all agree on that?
He's prioritised, but I can't say he's delivered.
Okay. I agree within that. But so I think the result shows that parts of Labour's more progressive, so they're almost feeling politically homeless now. They don't really stand in a specific area. They're all scattered about. You know, on immigration, Labour, you were saying Shabana Mahmood is more, you'd have her for the Tories. You were saying because she's much more right wing
than the general Labour Party, yes.
So they're quite split up, and this divide in their policies, especially with the cabinet ministers and obviously discontent with the backbenchers, that's not exact. I don't give Keir Starmer very long left. What would you say, Rory? How long would you give him?
I'm actually surprised he's still here. I'm surprised how muted the rebellion was. They only had one Scottish MP, I think another Northern MP, and obviously Carl Turner, who's kind of the troublemaker of the Labour Party right now. I think he's got... last week I said he would have been gone by the end of this week. I think Labour are just... They've got no... The problem with Labour is that they've got a terrible leader, but they have no one good enough to replace him. They've got Angela Rayner, who's in a tax scandal. They've got Wes Streeting, who's got... links to Peter Mandelson,
links to Jeffrey Epstein.
Jeffrey Epstein. They got Ed Miliband, who's already a proven election loser. They had Andy Burnham. Well, they could have had Andy Burnham, but he's not in Parliament anymore. So they're absolutely hopeless, the whole bunch of them.
Well, they kind of just have to stick with Keir Starmer, don't you think? Because if there's no one better to replace him, they're stuck with him for a while.
Exactly, but I think...
Unless it's a leadership change.
I think it's quite telling that they think they're going to get more success from a person who's polling at 15%. And is going to get an absolute electoral spanking.
Just
it's just
desperation, isn't it?
It just shows desperation. They've got nothing better to offer. They've got nothing better to actually... They've got no better results to rely on. And they've got no better people to lean on. It's terrible. So I think that when they're going to have to actually kind of risk it for some electoral dividends will be in May. I think he is going to have an awful May. Anas Sarwar, Scottish Labour conference. God knows what's going on up there because normally had Keir Starmer speaking, but he's obviously not invited because he's calling for Starmer to go. So I actually don't know what is going to happen. I think he's going to go in May. I think he should have gone last week. Like, this is crazy, to be honest.
I mean, you know, but he wouldn't resign after that. I mean, he has to.
He would.
You know, but he has to keep going.
Into third place. What do you mean he's going?
He's got
to
show some grit and resilience. Okay, he's the leader of the country. You don't always have an easy time in office. That's how great leaders are made, don't you think? Obviously, Keir Starmer's not a great leader, but
I think it's extremely disrespectful to the great prime minister of our country, notably Winston Churchill. You have some people who think he's quite controversial. He saved this country from Nazi Germany and dangerous ideologies. I do not think you can compare Keir Starmer's experience
I never said Winston Churchill.
You said he was a great...
I said that to make a great prime minister, you need to have grit and resilience. I know Keir Starmer's
not
in a great...
He's not in a great position.
He's not in a great position.
I have to side with Rory here. He hasn't shown much grit.
He's not going to show up after a by-election in which he's lost 30% of the vote.
But he has to show he's at least committed to the job.
And then saying because families were going
it's too late for that.
Families were going
ship
and
sailed
and
a year
like
and a half ago when he won this election, and there's just been scandal after scandal, resignation after resignation, failure after failure on all fronts.
He's got nothing left. Yeah, I agree with you. But we don't want... Okay, if he resigns, then that's not exactly going to help us, because all we're going to see is another terrible Labour MP come in, completely mess up the country even more with some rubbish statements and some, like, going off the charts in all the different immigration, housing, energy, and it's just not going to work out.
If I can just comment here, like, between the two of you, I think that partly Max is right. I think that, like, doing him resigning, and as you said yourself, Roy,
it's not a great
about,
prime
like,
minister.
About like what the options they have left
are made
is
by being resilient.
Yeah, but
he's not resilient.
I know he's not resilient. That's why I want him to stay in office.
Because you want him to stay in office because he's not resilient.
No, I want him to stay in office because I want him to show some backbone. Okay, that's the whole thing he's been doing is apologising.
If you care about a politician with a backbone, I'm sure there'll be. Even though I fundamentally disagree with them on a whole lot of issues, the left-wing caucus of the Labour Party are far more passionate, far more stronger in their views compared to Keir Starmer. As Kemi Badenoch said a few months ago, he's a wind veil. He's got no views. Like, I ask, like, what's the first word you think of Keir Starmer? First,
spineless.
I think failure. Second, I think weak. He's like, I don't know what he's offering.
Okay.
That was the problem.
All right, okay. Let's just de-escalate this. Okay. So I see what you mean. Okay. Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, and I know that you obviously support the Conservatives wholeheartedly. That's a fair point to say, I think. Okay. But okay, Keir Starmer. Okay, we don't know what he believes, and we don't think the party's being run by him. Okay? But if he were to resign, who would take over? There is no one. So
there
that's
no
why
one.
I want him to just
wait, Rory,
go
yes
out
or no,
there,
do you
make
think
a statement.
That he should resign?
Yes.
And you've also told us that there's literally no one else.
There's no one else.
So there's no one. So he has to stay in.
He has to stay in office.
None of us are saying that he's doing a good job.
You both say that he's been controlled by Labour MPs. What's the difference if he's not there? Surely other Labour MPs are just gonna win the power vacuum. You're saying he's being controlled by Labour MPs. If he goes, then he's got no influence right now. So what influence is he going to have if he's not there?
Well,
there's no loss.
Those Labour MPs might not be able to appeal. Well, no, okay. Keir Starmer does not appeal to the population now, okay? Right. But a year ago he did.
Yes.
And the way that he was able to do that led to a landslide victory. So I don't feel like
he's... A very shallow victory.
I don't think the general election last year was shallow.
No, it was shallow, as in, like, if you look at the majorities, hundreds of them are less than 2,000. What's his name? A lot of constituencies, former Tory constituencies, some were won by just 20 votes. Like, I think that was Hendon or Poole that was won by 20
votes.
Okay,
but it's not about how many votes, it's who won the seat.
No, yes, I know, but the point is, if he loses those votes, he's no longer the largest party, so he loses a lot of seats. It's not proportional.
Yeah, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah,
it's a large majority, but it's a very shallow majority.
So, so going back to what you originally said, if he's being controlled by his own party, then what's the point in him like being in control in the first place?
Yes.
Then what would be? Do you think that having another of their own MPs as the leader of the party, do you think that should be something that should happen to make a difference?
If I was a Labour strategist, and I saw this Gorton-Denton by-election. The Greens are on 19% of the vote in a poll that I saw today. Labour, I think, was on 17%. If you had a left-wing person who actually ran the Labour Party, you'd appeal far more to the Green voters and you'd bring them back in, and then maybe you can have some electoral prominence or a shot at winning, which you don't have right now. Obviously, I'm much more right-wing, conservative, than most of the Labour voters, so I clearly don't agree with a lot of them. But if I was a strategist, I see where the votes are going. They're going to the Greens. So I would therefore act and appeal more to them by being more left-wing. And I think Keir Starmer, he just carries too much baggage. If you have to bring in a fresh left-wing face if you wanted to appeal to those Green voters, who we've seen last week actually lost Labour a really safe seat. And that is what I think are concerning a lot of Labour MPs. That's why they're making their little moves, even though we're probably not seeing it. I said I'm surprised why there's been no kind of rebellion. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a rebellion brewing up right now and we wake up in a few weeks' time and we see that some cabinet secretary, maybe West Streeting, just to kind of play with current affairs, resigns, and then that triggers a huge backlash, and now then he gets deposed as leader, and they bring in someone left.
Okay, but if West Streeting resigned, why?
And it's just a hypothetical.
Okay, fine.
It's a hypothetical. Right, I'm saying if a cabinet secretary resigns, West
Streeting, that's going to put pressure on him. Okay, so that's tactical, isn't it?
Well,
they're just going to resign for someone else to come in, then get reappointed in a different role.
Yes. What's the problem with that?
No. I'm just saying that it's a sneaky way of trying to get a prime minister out. Just like
yes,
with,
it shows
with,
no confidence.
Yeah, like with Boris Johnson, yes. With Liz Truss. What happened with Liz Truss? Suella Braverman resigned. Suella Braverman did resign from
Liz
Truss.
Well, Kwarteng was sacked. Well, I don't think...
Kwarteng was sacked, and then
Truss
Suella Braverman resigned.
Truss was different because it wasn't the people resigning that triggered her resignation. It was the crash. I think Boris Johnson, you could say...
Okay, fine. With Rishi Sunak
and Sajid Javid resigning, that triggered a huge backlash of Conservative MPs who just called it quits. You're not delivering good polling, which is quite rich for them to say, looking at where they are right now. But... That is what triggered rebellion against Boris Johnson. That's what got him out. I think Keir Starmer, he's going to say, oh, we want stability, but you're on stability towards annihilation. That's the track that you're going on. You're not going
to
level off the decline.
You're on stability to annihilation.
Well, yeah, and that's, I think I'd say the same thing about Rachel Reeves in the economy. She wanted stability. Yes, you've delivered on stability, but in the complete wrong direction. But now going down, she wants to go up. So I think she's been a bit too vague on that. I don't know if that's been her entire pledge this entire time. Touch wood, it hasn't.
Are we going to get onto Iran?
Yeah, we'll get onto Iran soon.
But I think if I was a Labour strategist, I'd get rid of Keir Starmer. I'd get rid of Keir Starmer. And I'd appeal more to Green voters by having a clean slate with a left-wing person who would appeal to them. And I think that is the main lesson that we should have learned from this by-election last week.
You know, I now agree with you, Rory.
Yeah.
I think you know that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that
my
having a fresh face and sort of trying to persuade
but I think
those
it
green
is very,
voters
yes.
towards them again. Yeah.
I think it's important. I am not part of the Labour Party. It's not going to be a witch hunt. I don't support them. But if I was a strategist, that's what I would do.
We're now moving on to our second segment, and we're now moving abroad. And we're going to be focusing on the USA, Israel, and Iran. And this escalation has ultimately led to the supreme leader of Iran, the Ayatollah's, death. Now, Rory, I'm just going to put it out there. Quite a blunt question, I think. Are you glad the Ayatollah's dead?
Good riddance. I mean, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, I mean, he represented the most evil, the most disgusting of what this planet could offer. He decided to kill people. No.
Yeah.
You think he's funny that he's led a regime that
you just came out of the box quite fast as well.
No, I like the passion from
yeah,
you.
Yeah,
no.
It's very,
no, but,
very,
no, but
very,
I think that's
very
what
committed.
A lot of people think. I'm thinking on a lot of different kind of caps today, but if I was an Iranian mother and I found out that my son had been shot dead by the IRG, Iran Revolutionary Guard, the IRG.
The IRGC, yeah. It's God's corpse, but yeah.
Yeah, okay, IRGC.
Cheers,
I would be... Yes, okay, thanks for the... thank you for the fact-checking service that we get here. But I would be absolutely... I'd be so angry, and I'd be so upset at the same time. And that is the direct orders of Khamenei. Thank God he's dead. He deserved to die, quite frankly. I mean, unbelievable the things he's done.
Yeah.
So, do we all agree on that?
I agree that he had a murderous regime with a corrupt guard that killed its own people. Are you welcoming
his death?
Do you think it's the first time?
I am welcoming his death. It's just the grounds that we need to obviously consider. And we'll move on
to
that later.
To talk about the grounds.
That's the main controversial bit.
If I woke up this morning and you told me that he was dead, not this morning, and you didn't tell me why, I'd be happy. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So wait, is your opinion on his death changed considering the way he died?
Slightly, but I'm still happy.
Okay, fine. I'm glad we're on the same page, isn't that?
Yeah.
You're welcome to death.
I welcome his death, but it's
even the circumstances in which they occurred.
Yes, but what is interesting, to be honest, is how quickly this escalated. I mean, Trump was in negotiations with him, maybe just around last week, and insider reports had said that negotiations were going well. So what has prompted Trump to suddenly go in and assassinate the leader. I know.
Yes, no. But before we just go on to your insider reports, we have Steve Witkoff saying that he's made incredible progress in every single talk.
Is this are you talking about the Iranian or Trump?
Steve Witkoff is envoy of the US. He's trying to solve what's going on in Ukraine. He said that he's making tremendous progress with the Russians and the Ukrainians on a peace deal. He said that for months now. He said he's made incredible progress after countless negotiation and talks that they've gone into. But where's the peace deal? So clearly they're going to say that made tremendous progress just to cover up the fact
that they must have collapsed.
They clearly collapsed. I think you can also draw from that. If they're saying it's going really well, maybe that's a deception tactic that are saying, okay, we're still at the table. We're definitely not going to strike you, like, which is what they did. And they used a lot of deception tactics. They struck during the day, for example. And no one was going to think that would happen.
People naturally would be less
alert during the night. So that was kind of counterintuitive by the Americans. I think as far as the way in which the Americans carried out their attack, look, I think the Americans, as far as what they were trying to achieve, they struck military targets. They killed the Ayatollah. I think that was a general success. And I welcome
it.
I welcome it. I think the Israeli strikes, however, it was an Israeli strike that killed 40 schoolgirls in an Iranian school.
Yeah, that's what I was
think that
talk
is
about.
Absolutely abhorrent and disgusting on the Israelis' part. As well,
Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes,
the big Yahoo. Like,
the big.
Yes,
keep that in this one.
This time last year, I was pro-Israel. Then I moved slightly to pro. Then I was neutral. Now I'm pro-Palestine.
Okay, that is a conversation for another day.
That's a conversation.
I think we all agree here, right?
The way Israel is trying to go around everything is completely stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that the way. Okay, so the USA, their goal, obviously, with these strikes, obviously take out the Supreme Leader. Mm-hmm. And now they're trying to take out pretty much every single person that he had in place to ensure that the regime would continue upon his death. And now they're making the revolutionary, well, the IRGC, they want them to surrender and hand over their weapons.
Yes.
Because obviously they're the ones who are corrupt and handing out these attacks on people.
Yes.
And if they don't, then the USA have pledged to pretty much
annihilate them.
Massacre them all. And
I think massacre was probably a bit
maybe not,
in this
but,
context.
Okay, but when we think about the number of people that the USA are willing to kill if you think about how far away Iran really is from the USA, why is Trump actually trying to get involved in this?
Is it because he wants another
Nobel Peace Prize?
No. This is the complete opposite of winning a Nobel Peace Prize. He came in. Well, he won the election on the promise that he wouldn't start any foreign wars, so that's good promise from Donald Trump as well. But I think it's not the actual fact. He's going in there with the Israelis saying, oh, they're violating human rights. That's for the birds, that's what Rory Stewart said on The Rest Is Politics. But the reason he's going there, it's because of the nuclear deterrent. He said in June, when he completely destroyed all... quote-unquote destroyed all of Iran's nuclear capabilities. He clearly did not succeed because he's had to go in again and destroy it. But I think it's the actual thought of having of Iran as, well, the regime. I think the regime having access to nuclear weapons, that's much more dangerous. And I think those are totally acceptable and reasonable grounds to go into. He wasn't gone into a country, but to strike the people who are actually breaking laws.
Okay, I agree with that. Daniel, what do you...
I feel like this is going to be a hard topic to talk about because I essentially agree with what Roy's saying.
Okay, so if we move on to another aspect of the topic and we talk about Iran's counter-strikes pretty much. So these strikes obviously happened in Kuwait, the
Qatar,
UAE, Qatar, Dubai.
Bahrain. Dubai's in
a bit, yeah. And as you've already established... And, okay, if we're going to look at it from the perspective of Saudi Arabia as well, from a British tourist, okay, they're British tourists staying in a number of these places, and it must be quite frightening, really. I mean, I know we all agree on this, but...
Yeah, it must be terrifying.
It must be horrible to go on holiday there and not even be able
Yes, there are a lot of people on holiday, but there are also a lot of people who actually live there.
No, but that's the... Okay, but... Okay, so they live there. So what do you expect them to do about that if they already live there?
Well, surely they'll want to get out as well.
Okay.
I don't think you can just exclusively say this is tourists.
Well, no, but I'm talking about at least the from British the nationals perspective of a British...
Let's just take a step back. It's not ideal, is it? Like, realistically, like, everyone's...
Yes. Well, whatever circumstances,
it's obviously not ideal living in a place where there are obviously strikes. And
well, not normally, but yes.
Not normally, yeah.
But at the risk, yes.
And these obviously people would be very worried. And from the perspective, if we think of, if we go back home, the UK, and we think about Keir Starmer,
yes.
Okay, he, I mean, Steve Reed was talking. Okay, so John Healey, the Secretary of State for Defence, yep. For the Labour government, he has said that, okay, so he said that the UK played no part in these strikes, and then he was obviously questioned about it, yes. On Sunday, but and it was a good question, to be fair, from Laura Koonsberg. She mentioned that why can Canada and Australia show their stance on this, but Keir Starmer can't?
Yeah,
Rory, do you think that Keir Starmer should either, as we mentioned before, show some backbone and either condemn the strikes or support the USA or even stand up to Trump as well? He needs to show that.
Well, I think
the US, yeah. The UK are actually, we don't really want to get involved in this old debacle, really, do
yes.
we?
No, well, I mean, Donald Trump, he's called Starmer's Che Guevara a great act of great stupidity. He's called very, he's said that Keir Starmer's actions were very disappointing as far as allowing the use of British military bases like the Chagos Islands, which I think should remain British. I don't know why they're being given to Mauritius, because they're like 5,000 billion miles away, which is a whole other argument. But I think the fact that Trump is completely bullying our Prime Minister, who I have no sympathy for, but at the same time, he doesn't feel like he has any authority to stand up to Trump, tells you all you need to know about Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
He is. I go back to my favourite word describing Keir Starmer. He is weak. Keir Starmer has literally just, he's only just criticised Trump over his Iran strikes, going to the BBC. And he has defended the UK's position as far as not getting involved with, which I think is sensible.
Which is, yeah, he kind of has to go down the middle, sort of,
well,
in a way.
If I can chime in here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Jonathan Healey, I would say is lying about we saying no, have been informed of any of these strikes. I think that like USA would definitely be telling England beforehand,
yes.
Doing these strikes. I think that's a lie.
Yes.
Yeah. Also now like they try to be having no involvement, but also like now we were letting them use our military bases.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot not much transparency going on, I think, at the moment.
No.
I think sort of Keir Starmer also thinking he has to stay quiet. I mean, I agree with Rory here again. It is a bit weak, sort of spineless thing to do. And then also for Trump to openly criticise Keir Starmer on numerous occasions, and then Keir Starmer to feel as though he has to stay quiet, I think. I think there's something to say about that.
Yeah.
Shall we loop back to about the
tourist
strikes
gone wrong.
Strikes,
yeah.
From
okay.
Israel?
I think, like, this is, like, absolutely crazy. I mean, like, you're thinking about, I wouldn't say dreamland, but, like, the land of, like, perfection in, like, the form of Dubai.
Fantasy.
Well, yeah, I'd say, like,
well,
the
I've
Burj
got
Khalifa.
A lot to say about that, but...
Well, I mean, that's, like, them being struck, that completely goes against, like, that's unbelievable. Like, that's crazy.
Which strikes are you talking about here?
We're talking about the counter-strikes.
The counter-strikes.
Against Dubai and Doha.
Well, they haven't done anything. There's just...
Yeah, exactly. So why are they doing that?
No, they're just trying to show that they still have power, that even though they've killed the supreme leader, they're still a force to be reckoned with.
I just think that's completely unnecessary.
I think that's really weird on a number of fronts. I think if you think from a tactical perspective, you're trying to conserve actual... military
resources.
Why would you be doing it? Why would you be using it on blowing up the world's tallest building? Surely you'd be trying to do that on British or American bases,
no.
Or the carrier fleet. Why would you?
Because they're scared. They're worried about the people in people who worked for the Supreme, the people who obviously are mourning him.
Yeah,
I don't know why, but they're obviously
they're scared.
They're worried at what's going to happen to the regime, and the people who are still behind in the government.
Yeah,
who still support this regime want to show that Iran is still stable and able to, because the power of fear, especially when it comes to hard power, is obviously going to be very influential. I don't think this is going to escalate into a sort of World War III, really.
If I was, okay, hypothetically, I think a lot of people would be really scared, but if I was Prime Minister and...
Of which one? Which country?
Well, I'm not French, so it would clearly be the UK. If I was a Prime Minister of the UK and I got blown up and I got killed and obviously the nuclear kind of signals go out, I wouldn't just bomb up Iran just for the laughs, don't you think? Like, why would you? What's the point of even doing that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess.
Surely you'd use that to attack people who attacked you.
But at this point, when people are attacking you, rationality goes out the window.
Okay, fine, but I think they have a really. I think it'd be quite stupid that the Iranians have not planned for this.
Yeah, well, they obviously didn't expect for their supreme leader to be assassinated. They thought that these talks were going well.
They did not think the talks were going well.
They didn't think the talks were going well.
Well, if the Americans thought they weren't going well, I think it would be pretty telling that the Iranians also thought that the talks weren't going well, don't you think?
No, but okay, so if we bring in then another one of the topics that we're going to talk about now, which is the international law and the framework around the US and Israel's, obviously, attack on Iran... Mm. I don't feel like a country should have the power to just go into another country and assassinate its leader. There has to be another way.
I think, in principle...
There has to be a diplomatic way of sort of... Okay, I didn't agree. He was a horrible person.
Horrible man, yes.
Okay, and we've all agreed that his regime was despicable, really. But there has to be another way of getting him to... He was 86, okay? So he was going...
He was going out the door.
He was going to die at some point, but the thing that the USA and Israel are concerned with is that the regime is going to continue because of how many people he had lined up to replace him.
Yeah.
So the thing is that they were thinking about is they have to strike now. It's now or never, pretty much.
Yes,
is what they're thinking
I think
about.
It's use it or lose it.
I think I'm going to agree with what Rory was about to say there. Was like,
you don't even need him to speak to agree with me.
What about me?
Yeah, I also about what Max, I think, was saying, is that in principle, it's terrible. Like, you cannot just be going, I think they did it before with Colombia, where you can't just go into another country and do something like that. They feel like they have the power to do so. I thought Trump thinks he's the power to do so. Principle, I think it's terrible. I mean, I'm not mourning his death or anything like that. I think that ultimately it's a good thing that what's happened. I think also, like, counter-strikes is completely unnecessary.
What's going on there.
And with, if we just switch over to American politics.
Let
me do the my bit.
No, we don't need to do that though.
All right, go on. Go on then.
Okay. Go, wait, are we still live?
Yeah, we're still live.
Okay, fine.
That's fine. Get banned on the pod.
What was I going to say?
They never say that.
Yes, no, I think, okay, look, in principle, I think the US strikes were, in principle, unspecifically, I don't think a country should just go in and either take their leader in the case of Venezuela or assassinate their leader in the case of Iran.
When I say Colombia, by the way.
That's fine, don't worry.
He'll cut it out because he fact checks everything pretty much.
But I think, in principle, I think that's not okay. I think in this case, it is okay. Because, and I'm not saying that this is not like two-tier justice, whatever the reform want to say, but I think it's really important that, look, I think he's an exception to the rule. I think Maduro is an exception to the rule. There are a lot of autocratic dictators who actually don't have the mandate or the authority, even though they might have that in strength. I don't think they don't deserve to be the leader of their country in the sense that they weren't like elected or fairly elected. In the last 20 years. I mean, the Ayatollah, he was in power since 1989, and Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister then. So think about if Margaret Thatcher was still the Prime Minister. God rest her soul.
She would have shown some backbone, wouldn't she?
She would have actually shown
whether she supported the USA or not. Instead
I support of the USA.
Making it cryptic.
I think Keir Starmer is the definition of weak and cryptic. But at the same time, which is quite strange... But the point is, I think in this scenario, in this case, I think the Americans were right to go in, not just for the sake of international safety, but also for the safety of the Iranian people. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I 100% agree, to be
Daniel,
honest.
Daniel, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree.
And I just, for those who are listening who don't know about the supreme leader in Iran's role and about what it was. So the supreme leader controlled the military, he had judiciary oversight and was able to control foreign policy. And the way that a succession would work is that the assembly of experts formally appoints successor, but the IRCG is widely seen as highly influential. So the question is here, really, where does Iran go next? Is Iran ready to become a republic, or should they introduce a constitutional monarchy, as seen with the French in the past, Rory? Anything? Do you think?
Yes, I think they are in. They are a republic. They are the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think, as far as constitutional monarchy, which I think is very interesting, I do think that Iran should have a constitutional monarchy because I think they should bring back. What's his name? What's his face? The crown, former crown prince. I'm just searching it up now. Oh yeah, Reza Pahlavi.
Yeah.
Who was the son of the former Shah. Who they got deposed in 1979. But I think, like, there's, I think even a constitutional monarchy will be more democratic than what they've got currently. So I think that is definitely the most optimal direction, not just for the kind of the geopolitical environment, but also for, like, the Iranian people as far as their safety is concerned, instead of having this autocratic regime that cares and dictates what they do in every aspect, yeah. What they can say, in, if they say anything, when they get killed, how they get killed, whatever. But yeah, I think in the most, there's obviously some really hard line, die hard.
Yeah, so I feel as though the people who are mourning his death, so to speak, we're getting the better end of the deal of the regime.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
And so I don't think, also it's like important to say that those who are protesting against the regime and trying not to get another leader in power are being sort of arrested and beaten. So I think there's something to say about the fact, like, people who are publicly mourning are being allowed to publicly mourn, but the ones that are trying to protest for change in the country are being beaten and arrested.
And in terms, obviously, Rory, you said this regime has been going since 1989.
His reign. Yeah,
his reign has been going since 1989. So it's obviously quite a long time to be in power.
Yes.
I personally feel like the Iranians are going to perhaps struggle, especially the ones who are celebrating the death of the Ayatollah, to be able to actually take power.
Yeah.
Don't you think? Because, okay, a regime, it's obviously lasted for a really long time. That means it's embedded deep in the foundations of the way that the country works.
Well,
its
yes.
judicial system, the way that the IRCG works.
Yeah.
So the next step for the Iranians is being able to stop the IRCG handing out potential attacks because of the celebration.
Well, yeah,
their supreme
commander, he also got killed in the strikes, thank God.
Yeah.
They are a terrorist organization. I think this presents a kind of a question as far as strikes are concerned. I think at the same time, I'm not going out there condemning Trump's strikes, but I think a lot of people will think that a lot of people who are against Trump's strikes, they will think, oh, these are absolutely terrible. I'm against strikes, like, full stop. But at the same time, Iran, as far as the regime, is at the weakest point it's been for decades.
Yeah.
So I think this is kind of the time to properly strike. This is the time to get strike, not in the strikers in, like, not obviously explicitly strike. I think as a side point, the US should strike even more targets just to completely, like, they've cut the head off the snake. I think they should completely chop the snake up. I think.
What?
What do you mean, what? Like, the point is, the Iranian people can't like, fight for themselves. They can fight themselves, but they can't.
Okay,
if they had a rebellion, they would not win. And you've just said that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But so I think the only way they could win is if the US exerts even more pressure.
Yes, okay.
I think then that form, they're obviously not going to send troops in, but that would have to come to the form of strikes. So then would you rather have no strikes, but have a heavily weakened, but still a regime running Iran? Or do you have even more strikes and not have a regime anymore?
Okay, what I want to bring up is...
But what would you do?
Okay, no, but can I...
Answer my question, then I'll answer yours.
What was your question again? Can you repeat it, please?
Would you rather have the US strike even more and get rid of the regime, or the US not strike, but there's no real...
Okay, it depends on the extent that the US strike
at. Let's just say the US completely...
If they completely obliterate the entire system that he had set up...
Yes. The regime. It's a quick way, and I feel like
with reducing the strikes, okay, as seen with revolutions in the past, eventually power is regained some way or another from those who still support the regime. So I think if the USA carried out the rest of the strikes, completely demolish the rest of the regime,
yes,
that is a good decision for me.
You would approve of that decision?
I would approve of that, yes.
How about you, Daniel?
I think, obviously, like, we should avoid violence when...
Let me finish. Go on.
Okay, I think avoiding violence is the, like, best way to go around things. But will there be more violence if they don't have strikes and there's a massive bloodbath full of the sort of younger generation of Iranians trying to fight for their country? Yes, there will be. So, I mean, I'm not going to say it, but I think as though, like, that is probably the better thing to do.
So you think there should be more strikes?
That is a totally valid view. We all agree that violence
not be promoted. But when it comes to preventing a murderous regime,
I think you got to think about it in this way. Strikes are only going to kill people like that. Then, like, that's where the violence sort of ends. If you keep the regime, you're going to have continued violence for decades.
Yeah.
And more uprisals from the people who are being oppressed after that.
So that's more of a long-term kind of... I'm not going to say genocide. But realistically, they're killing a group of people who believe in a certain thing, which is freedom and democracy, frankly. So I think personally, I welcome the strikes. I welcome the Ayatollah's death. I welcome the supposed crumble of the regime and the weakening of it. But I think in the future, I would support further strikes to completely kill the regime. I would make it very clear that I don't, the regime, I'm totally against. But the Iranian people, I have a lot of sympathy for. I think if you...
They've had to live with this for...
I think if you think of their interests, more strikes, ironically, against Iran will actually be better for them. And that's what I believe, because otherwise they're just going to be continually oppressed by a regime that will be probably even more aggressive, because it's seen that pragmatic talks have clearly not worked. So I think in their best interests, I think President Trump should have more strikes just to completely get rid of any doubt.
Yeah, and just to wrap up, I think obviously I agreed with you about more strikes happening, but I feel like Donald Trump has to not get too carried away.
I agree. I think he's definitely the most dangerous person. Yeah. If you're going for a strike, it's not.
Definitely. I feel like the reason I was sort of tiptoeing around further strikes is the fact that he's a very predictable character, and I feel as though there could very easily be unnecessary amounts of strikes going into Iran. I think also at the end of the day, we have to take a step back and realize what Iran was before the regime, and it's sort of quite a beautiful country really in the Middle East.
Very liberal
country. People, women walking outside feeling safe, not having but like it was quite a nice place, and I feel as though like ideally it should go back to that in my Western view. So
thank you guys. So this week we've seen a shock green victory in Labour territory, the rise of Zach Polansky as a more confrontational voice on the left, and potentially historic geopolitical change in Iran, from local by-elections to global succession crises. Politics remains defined by instability and shifting coalitions. The question isn't just who wins power, but who can sustain it responsibly. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Ballot, and join us next week as we continue unpacking the forces shaping politics at home and abroad. See you next time.
Thank you.